Hey everyone, and welcome back to Purple Row Radio. Okay, I hesitated there, and I'll tell you why. Because every time I say this, every time I tell you guys, welcome to Purple Row Radio, I try so hard to make sure I'm not saying Robot Radio. Even though we changed the name, like, 3 months ago? No, we changed it at the beginning of the year. So
yeah, it's been Purple Radio for a while now. Yeah. Just want to keep saying Robot Radio.
Well, I don't. I'm totally set on Purple Row Radio, but I just overthink it when I say it. So this edition is for Monday, July the 4th. Hey, it's a holiday podcast. I didn't even think about that.
We should edit in Stars and Stripes Forever or something like that.
I should replace. I'm gonna take that audio clip from you doing that and have that open the show. No, I'm not.
Yes, just do that. That'd be great.
I was gonna say that I should replace the theme music with the Star Spangled Banner, but really, I don't have time to do that.
Whatever works for you, Greg.
Yes, this special holiday edition of Purple Row Radio will be, not particularly spirited in terms of, actual holiday content. It's been a kind of a chaotic schizophrenic week for following the team.
What? Greg, don't you want to hear my off topic comment before we start actually talking about baseball?
We have a reasonably long interview to include in this podcast, but if you have one on your mind, go for it.
I'll make it fast because everyone's going to enjoy it. Okay, so if you're a Simpsons fan, which I know that a lot of people aren't anymore because the Simpsons just aren't funny anymore and haven't been for about a decade, if you roll back to the early to mid to late 90s even, Simpsons are hilarious. But they had this one recurring, gag when they're watching TV, and that was the McBain movies. The McBain's, for those of you who aren't aware, is just kind of a spoof of, Jean-Claude Van Damme crossed with Arnold Schwarzenegger, crossed with Steven Seagal, crossed with whoever. Just, your typical action movie where way too much gunfire and, blood everywhere and terrible one-liners. Anyways, apparently if you took all the McBain clips from 1991 through 1993 and stitched them together, they actually make a cohesive movie.
Really?
You wouldn't believe it. I hate to say it because I was reading Cracked Magazine, because that site tends to put up articles that are very silly to read because they're about movies and crazy crap like that.
Cracked bought one of my favorite comedy websites, and that's how I first found them.
Ah, well, there you go. I just find them. I don't know why I find them. I just find them. And honestly, they had the video linked, and it's 4 minutes long, and it's actually a relatively cohesive plot. I mean, yeah, there's still obviously, going to be holes in it and stuff, because, I mean, come on, we're talking about a Simpsons, one-off gag that just happened to happen, a dozen times or whatever, but it's a four-minute video, and it actually kind of makes sense. It's insane. You can YouTube it really easy. Just look for, McBain movie, or do I still have it up? Let's check my other windows. Let's see, McBain. Nope, no McBain. But yeah, now that I've told you what to do, go do it. It's entertaining as all get out.
That is really, really bizarre. I was never a huge fan of that show, but I watched it enough in syndication when I was in middle school, when it was on twice on Fox, at 5 and 5:30 or something like that, that I know exactly what you're talking about. And that is kind of unusual because it always seemed like it was just these random little vignettes that were, pastiching those Schwarzenegger-Stallone-type movies that you were mentioning before. I wouldn't have taken any stock in trying to develop it into some sort of narrative continuity.
Well, that's just the thing. Matt Groening Productions typically have a lot of good, weird behind the scenes continuity like that. Not even continuity, but there's a lot of effort put into the Easter egg. It's not just, oh, there's that thing again. It's better than that. Futurama, there's apparently a couple hidden languages in the show.
Yes.
And the graffiti and stuff, and I'm not gonna bother. I mean, I read something about it and I was hoping they just have a translation for everything, but I'm I don't really wanna go look this up, but.
Now, unlike The Simpsons, I am a huge fan of Futurama, and I've, seen all of those episodes many times, and can absolutely attest to the complexity behind some of the very background elements of that series.
But I almost feel like with Futurama, because it was such like a, I mean, yeah, it's Simpsons in space. There's like kind of no doubt about that. But because it became less of like this cultural phenomenon, and it was just, I feel like he almost had more freedom to do more bizarre things and make it a better story. And I like Futurama better than just about any other cartoon, you know, sitcom kind of show.
Do you watch the current ones that are airing right now?
I'm honestly, I haven't gotten back into them yet, and it just because it was such a long time before they had new ones. I watched the three made for TV movies, and
there were four of those.
Four of them. My mistake. But I just kind of let it die after that, and they're like, oh hey, new episodes. I'm like, oh hey, I'll. Okay, so I mean, typically I'm the kind of person who'll just Netflix them or Hulu or whatever your online viewing of choice is, but I'll just kind of binge on them there and then be like, oh, hey, that's pretty great, because I hate waiting week to week. I'm not patient enough and I don't care enough about television to do that.
I certainly do, but, you know, that's just my field there, so I obviously am one of the ones who wants to watch all these things as soon as possible. Anyway...
Yeah, you mentioned something about baseball. Did we talk about baseball on the show?
Yes, I think so, even though I would probably rather be doing a podcast on television. But
you'll be there eventually.
Yeah, maybe that will come in the future. Although I have a big super upcoming television project that I have just begun that some people who read my Facebook might know what that is, but I'm really excited about it. But I'm not going to talk about that anymore at this point because I don't know when it's going to be ready. Probably many months from now. Baseball, Mark Ellis. That's what I was talking about.
Mark Ellis.
I was saying before we started talking about all that it's been kind of a chaotic and schizophrenic week, and I say that because the Rockies have made like more MLB level roster moves over the past like 4 days than they have in the past like 4 weeks. And after that crazy time when we like called up Nelson and Young and Blackman and Brothers like all in the same like 12 days or so, since then it's been pretty quiet. And just now we're starting to readjust a little bit even more. And we've seen obviously little cameo appearances from Greg Reynolds and Edmer Escalona, and but the main transaction here has been obviously the acquisition of Mark Ellis. Debuted to some concern. You know, I mentioned back a month ago or so when we were making all those roster moves that I was going to get worried if it continued that they were going to start making moves for the sake of moves, you know, saying, oh look, we're trying, so on and so forth. We gave up on so and so.
This is a low cost move though. I'm okay with it being just a move for the sake of a move. Cause honestly, they gave away Bruce Billings and what, cash? Or no, they got cash and gave away a player to be named later.
Right, and Oakland ate $2 million of his remaining $3 million.
This was a very, very low risk move for the Rockies. I mean, yeah, it's $1 million, whatever. That's not gonna, if $1 million really hinders the Rockies' ability to make an impact move, you know, they were full of crap to begin with. And that's never been the case. The Rockies always undersell their ability to make payroll moves.
And they've been doing that publicly too, because O'Dowd is kind of painting the picture that don't expect any super fantastic moves because my pocket change is getting a little thin, but it never really ends up being the case. And over the past couple of years, except last year, but over the two, 3 years ago, we've still been making moves into the late July pre-trade deadline period. Obviously, Rafael Betancourt was probably the most significant of those acquisitions over the past few years. But yeah, I mean, I didn't really take a position on Ellis because the move kind of came out so far out of left field for me that I didn't really have any time to study into or think really hard about what it meant. But, you know, the first thing that most people are going to do is look at, oh, well, how did they do this year? And when they notice that Mark Ellis has actually been less productive than Chris Nelson, there was a little bit of concern. But obviously, they're completely different players in completely different stages of their career, and that really wasn't taken into account. And plus, there was also some initial concern because Mark Ellis was initially very upset about being traded. 10-year, veteran of the Oakland A's, and you know, he was their longest tenured player at the time, and you know, he obviously felt probably pretty heartbroken about having to move on, but gotta say, his first couple of games with the Rockies doesn't look like there's any lingering psychological disappointment issues there.
Well, before we move on, actually talk about Ellis, I mean, I don't think that I think I hedged my bets pretty well with our existing second base candidates, except for possibly Lopez. I think I might have overcommitted myself to his camp. But with Nelson, I mean, he had such a hot start and then just completely fell off the face of the planet as far as batting, and he was never, I mean, he made a couple of nifty plays, which is great to watch, but, you know, had some clutch errors as well, and, you know, I still think there's hope for him to be some sort of a utility guy, because he can kind of play third, and he can kind of play second, and I'm sure they could, and he can kind of play shortstop, obviously.
At this point, they're saying that they intend for Nelson to actually go in the opposite direction, and they're only going to play him at second base now.
That's probably the smartest. We've talked about this before, and I won't make a big deal out of this, so we could talk about this for half an hour if we wanted to, but I don't get what it is with the Rockies and saying, oh, we have this position locked up with Tulowitzki. Let's keep shortstops to shortstop. I mean, I get you don't want to move a young developing guy out of position and make, if they're having troubles with the bat, and have them have to figure out how to bat while learning, you know, a new position. But at the same time, like, they're going to have to do it on the fly then, and then have the stress of being in the majors on top of that. Yeah, I don't think, at least with Nelson, I don't think they're really giving him too much of an opportunity to excel. And yes, a lot of, you know, 99 to 100% of the onus is on him, because he's the one who has to swing the bat. But that 1%, maybe half percent, I mean, it's something to think about. And we've mentioned it before, but I won't harp on it any longer. It just raises my eyebrow a little bit. But, you know, when it comes to minor league, you know, organizations and stuff like that, I don't want to pretend I know everything because I can read a stat line, and I don't want to pretend I know everything because I am able to read, you know, Jack Atkins, you know, minor league roundup stuff on Inside the Rockies. The minor leagues, watching movies like Sugar or Bull Durham or whatever, they give you a little bit of insight into minor leagues and how they work and stuff like that. And, you know, it's being a major league fan, living in the major league city, and not being the kind of person who lives in Asheville, North Carolina, or South Carolina. Help me, Greg.
I believe Asheville is in North Carolina.
I believe it is too, because Matt went to North Carolina last year. Anyways, the point stands. It's not like I have season tickets to the Tourists or the Nuts or something like that. I'm a major league fan, and that's how it works. And we follow the minor leagues because they're important to us. But so, Nelson, you know, go down, kick some butt, man, because you have it in you. I know you got it in you. You turned a corner, you came up, and you made some fireworks early on in your stint. But, you know, let's see what you got still. Your career with the Rockies is not over just yet.
And yeah, I would still say, and again, I'm talking about a projection here, and I always have to really, really explain what that means when it comes to me, because I hate making predictions. And what I'm saying is, Nelson is probably the odds-on, like, just from a systemic perspective, favorite for the second base job next year. Most people are going to hear that and say that I am saying that it is likely that Chris Nelson will be the second baseman next year. That's not what I mean. What I mean is, he's a player who's out of options and who has been considered over the past couple of years as a potential starting second baseman, and he's the only one in the organization, because one thing that the acquisition of Mark Ellis does mean is we finally have a player on our 40-man roster who will be a free agent at the end of the season. Unless we re-sign Ellis or make a trade or some such, which may in fact be more likely to happen than just giving the job to Chris Nelson, those moves haven't happened yet. And when you just follow our current group of players forward another 9 months, it's Nelson in that spot.
And, you know, we'll move on from Nelson to Ellis here, but it's really, 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 really early to say these things, so I'm kind of with you on the projecting Nelson as the starting second baseman, because with a guy like Ellis, you just never know what you're going to get. Oakland's been re-signing him for years and years and years, obviously, because, I mean, I remember reading articles about how he was a trade candidate or a DFA candidate or whatever, and the team would come to a deal with him and he'd be the second baseman again and, you know, put up an excellent year with a glove and a questionable year with a bat, and that's just kind of the story of Mark Ellis. But I guess the difference with Ellis as compared to any other second baseman we've had, the closest one I can make a comparison to in this regard would be Barmas. Because we know Barmas, I mean, the advanced metrics didn't love him at second base, they loved him at shortstop, and oh man, when Barmas was on his game at shortstop, he was just a joy to watch. I loved watching Barmas field shortstop, but he was far from a problem at second base. And with Ellis, though, we're getting kind of the same thing, but in a different direction. Neither of them are, we're getting all a glove first, bat second kind of guy. With Barmas, he was, you know, dead red fastball, and he had, and I think it was 09 where he took 23 over the fence.
Yeah, and he had a power surge there. In fact, you may recall that season of, power made me compare Barmas to Jose Lopez, even though their offensive games are, different to an extent.
They're both free swingers and they don't walk much. That's about
exactly right. And they both had really good 2009s because those were the seasons where they got the best opportunities to hit home runs.
Yeah, I still remember Barmas taking one over the center field wall in Washington, and that was no small feat. He crushed that thing. But, you know, Barmas being aside, with Ellis, you're getting a top notch, just a top flight second base glove. I mean, you could make the case that he is, you know, top five second baseman defensively in Major League Baseball easily. I can't imagine anyone really arguing with that too much. He's not the best second baseman. That's not, what I'm driving at. But as far as the Rockies' commitment to infield defense, despite their, you know, saying this year we're going to sacrifice some defense for offense, that was also kind of with Stewart in mind because they're bringing Wigginton in. But, you know, it seems like they want to kind of get back to where they are, or where they were, I should say, with, you know, backing up their ground balls and having Ellis going to do just that.
Of course, we've discussed this many times on the show and on the blog, but the defense, very key to our organization just from our pitching philosophy. Put it in play on the ground. And you want players who, even if they're not, you know, superstar defenders, you want players who are going to be capable enough to not make us regret that organizational philosophy, because it's going to be pretty obvious when that happens. If we ever have a really bad infield, that by itself could significantly cripple our season.
Oh yeah, totally. But with Ellis coming in, we get a veteran second baseman, which is, you know, whatever that means. It's good to have, I guess I'm kind of glad that we have a veteran there rather than have to be playing the, well, he's a rookie, well, he's young, well, he's a head case, you know, things like that at second base. And, you know, I think they're just going to stick with Ellis until he absolutely, assuming this ever happens, which it's probably gonna, but until he forces his way out of the lineup. And Ellis has never been known for his bat. And granted, that's also has a lot to do with coming out of the Oakland Coliseum, where the foul ground is about as big as Rhode Island, but...
Also, it's in California and is therefore a pitcher's park.
Yeah. So you get all the nifty little pitchy things going on there that hurt Ellis. But so far he's made a lot of noise for the Rockies. The WAR stats are really questionable in the short term, and I will never back down from that. But so far, and this isn't even counting today, Sunday's game. We're sitting there watching Sunday's game, and Matt pulls up FanGraphs and he says, "Hey, do you realize that Mark Ellis is already at like a .4 WAR at second base?"
In two games.
He fell a triple short of the cycle in his debut on Friday and had another three-hit game on Saturday, and he hit another home run today.
He did, and did he hit more doubles, or were all those doubles in the first
two games? I'd have to pull out the box score. I mean, this is one of those games where I'm not gonna lie, when we went down early, I was like, alright, we're flipping back and forth now. But, I don't know. I mean, so far it's a very exciting start, but let's also remember Chris Nelson had a very exciting start to his 2011 campaign. I'm not saying that they're the same kind of player, because obviously there's a zillion differences between the two of them, mm-hmm. as far as their baseball status, their veteranness, their approach to the play, all those things. But this is going to earn Ellis a lot of leeway going down the line, and I'm hoping that it doesn't turn around to bite us. I still will maintain that I don't think Ellis is going to be that great of a batter, even though he's shown completely otherwise so far in 2011 for the Rockies.
Do you think he can be at least better than some combination of Herrera Nelson in the two-hole?
I wouldn't doubt it. I don't like him in the two-hole still. I just don't, because...
Where would you hit him?
Oh, probably seventh. I mean, he's just not a two-hole hitter. He doesn't, I mean...
And you well, moved.
I take that back. He is a two-hole hitter, assuming we're looking at his upside, his, you know, his better career years and good things like that, with, you know, decent on-base percentage and, you know, good slappy skills. He's a decent, he's an okay hitter. at best. But if we can get an okay hitter at best with phenomenal, phenomenal second base defense, that's going to be an upgrade on everybody else we've tossed at second base. Like, no matter what. We'll have to see how the next week or so goes, see how he responds after the, you know, comes back after the break and does how he does in the month of July. But, you know, it makes you feel good about a trade like this to see him doing so well right off the bat. That's kind of what it comes down to. I still maintain that he's going to fall off, and I'm hoping that everyone doesn't, you know, run to the window to jump when Ellis, you know, eventually falls off a bit there. But
it never ceases to amaze me how many people will do that. Every once in a while, just I guess because I'm a masochist, I dropped by the old MLB forums, the Colorado Rockies official forum, and there's, you know, only three or four comments on there right now saying that, you know, we should just get rid of Clay Mortensen and Matt Belisle because they had bad games today.
Yeah, let's not forget that Belisle, if we exclude Belisle's game where he gave up, you know, six runs and all those other bad things like that, I mean, you can't just take that out because that's not fair, but he's got an ERA of like 2.5 again this year. Let's not forget that. The peripherals aren't backing it up as much as they did last year, but Belisle's having an okay season. There's no better way to slice it than that. He's had a bad game, but
The fan base also gave up really quickly on Matt Lindstrom.
True.
You know, everyone was really into Matt Lindstrom because early on in the season, I'm talking first 3-4 weeks, he was probably the only one of the new acquisitions that was really, really, making a case for himself as being a success. You know,
like 0.8 for the first month of the season or something like
that. And this is when Lopez and Wigginton were not doing much and so on and so forth. But, when it comes to someone like Mortensen, it's like, why do you get so offended when a pitcher like Mortensen has a bad outing? If you replace him or you throw somebody else out there in that game, it's not going to make a difference. We already lost the game. It's like, why is there such a desire to have like seven Houston streets in your bullpen or not Houston streets necessarily, but seven closer types, you know?
Because it's like, the Braves have seven closer types.
Yes, we'll get to that a little later. but except Scott Proctor apparently. Am I making my point here?
Clay Mortensen's the last guy in the bullpen. He's a long reliever. I do sincerely question why they sent Dan Escalona and brought up Greg Reynolds to make that start. I question why they did. I mean, because Tracy's saying that that Greg Reynolds' future is probably going to be in the bullpen. Hate to say it, but you know he's not really a starting caliber pitcher. And, you know, yes, everyone freak out about Evan Longoria and stuff like that now, because that's what you do when you mention Greg Reynolds. But why wouldn't they just throw Mortensen back in the rotation? It's not like he hasn't earned it.
Had he thrown a lot recently before that start? That's the only thing that I can think of. What was that?
That was Carlos. Yes, Carlos. They heard you going, durr, durr. He's sitting next to me looking at Imgur, and there's a picture of a cat in a bonnet, a knit bonnet, and he just starts laughing like an idiot over there, and I couldn't help but snicker a little bit as well, but I had to stifle it because I was on the line, but I unmuted it too soon, and he was still in his throes of overjoyed joy because of the cat with a bonnet on. So anyways, Mortensen, I never seem to take this into consideration when they last worked and stuff like that. That's usually one of my thousands of shortcomings as the baseball analyst, but I guess I don't understand why Mortensen's been looked at as dude to put in the bullpen and not get us another shot at starting. It's once again, we're really quibbling because I don't think that Mortensen would have done any better than Reynolds did. And we couldn't have predicted Jason Hamill blowing up the way he did on Sunday. Although some people who hate Jason Hamill probably had it predicted every single start, so you gotta be right at some point. So, I don't know. I guess I'm just kind of in Mortensen's corner. Even though his numbers are unsustainable and left on base percentage and batting average on balls in play and not a lot of strike, blah, blah, blah. Never mind all that stuff. Yeah, I get it. He's gonna fall apart. He's not that good of a pitcher. There's a reason he's the depth guy, but
Okay, so looking at Mortensen's game log, he probably should have been considered to make that start because he had only thrown 3 innings over the past week. That's certainly not, I mean, they probably wouldn't have put him out there for more than 5 or 6 innings, but you don't need your spot starter to really do any better than that.
He threw two
innings on the 27th against the Cubs, and then he'd thrown 1 inning on the 30th against the White Sox. And they didn't know they were going to need a starter until, what, July 1st or June 30th? Wait, what am I looking at here? Wrong month. June 30th or June 29th or some such like that. They still would have probably been able to throw him out there.
I would have liked to see it, but again, we won the game despite Reynolds, you know, not pitching well. And ultimately, that's all that matters. We're really talking. I mean, it's kind of sad when we're at the point of having to quibble about this in the back end of a rotation. But we'll just hope that Justine's elbow thing is nothing more than just he'll be fine. He just needed a week off. Mm-hmm. So. I guess I would have rather seen Edge Mass. The moves that they've made these last couple days, they didn't really make much sense until you reminded me about when Cole Garner's suspension ended because, you know, I was like, why would they call up Stultz? Oh, because they've had to use the bullpen a lot recently, but why would they call up Stultz? And when Smith got double switched out of the game, I don't know why I forgot that Smith got double switched out of the game because when Cargo ran into the wall, and from what I'm reading so far, for those of you who are listening before any kind of rock pile news comes out, it sounds like it's just a wrist bruise. He's going to be fine. No big deal.
Everyone on the radio broadcast was more concerned about his head than his hand.
He hit that wall pretty hard.
Yeah, they thought that his wrist was probably okay and that he might have a concussion. All I've heard is good news on his wrist. I haven't heard anything about...
Well, it's only reporting the wrist. I'm guessing it was just more of a shock when it knocked out of you.
Yeah, that's probably hopefully what it is.
So. I'm really not worried about him. I mean, it's a little scary that Renk mentioned the fact that his wrist, because his wrist was hurt last season when he came back, his power numbers just vanished for a while until they eventually came back, and we don't want to see him, you know, having to favor his wrist and not hitting for all those things like that. It sounds like he's going to be fine. They're probably going to give him a couple days off, but this makes a Cole Garner promotion that much more imminent. And what I was trying to say is that for some reason I've forgotten that Smith got double switched out of the game. He had 3 at bats and didn't get a hit in any of them. I felt kind of silly because I'm like, why would they put Wiggins in the right field? Put Smith in the right field. Blah, 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 blah. And then a couple people are like, Smith already played right field for a while. And I'm like, oh, right, I'm stupid. I mean, I guess I am kind of wondering why they didn't call up Garner. And that would have answered the question more. But it's kind of a question within a question that came out as just me being stupid because I wasn't paying enough attention earlier in the game because we were down by 1 million runs.
I should point out that I don't really know, actually, how much that suspension actually had to do with him not being called up because he was activated today from the suspension. They could probably have theoretically done it or called him up before the game. The only question there might have been, did they have to do it at a certain time of day? Did they have to wait until after the Rockies game was over? Because the Sky Sox are only just starting right now.
Yeah. Whenever you say theoretically about anything, I get what you mean and everyone listening gets what you mean, but coming from like a, you know, engineering school with science and being a big sci-fi nerd and stuff, I think theoretically, and then I picture like a bunch of, you know, baseball guys in white lab coats writing, you know, complex equations on a chalkboard with a baseball diamond. It's like, well, you see in theory and
And of course for me, theory is always film theory. I can identify with that too, except without the scientists and more like, you know, someone like me just sitting away in a dark corner typing a paper on a computer about theory.
I'm picturing film snobs wearing, you know, those French hats.
Most film snobs probably aren't that educated in film theory. They just like to pretend they are.
That's why they're snobs.
Oh, okay. I gotcha. So you can't be a snob about something if you actually know what you're talking about.
Well, that's not necessarily true either.
Yeah, I don't necessarily know, but I would agree that you are more likely to be a snob if you pretend you know what you're talking about.
Fair enough. I guess I'm not picturing baseball snobs drawing on a chalkboard. I'm just thinking, you know, like, what are the limitations of a roster as far as an outfielder coming up from AAA after serving an expansion and they're doing mathematics and the limit is goes to infinity and, you know, man. We got like big nasty graphs and stuff.
Of course, I only go so in depth with that because it's just kind of the skill that I've picked up amongst getting the opportunity to write for a baseball blog. Everybody on the blog kind of has their own specialty and it just so happens that this has kind of turned into mine, so.
Baseball theory?
No,
roster theory.
Roster theory specifically, but we've had some theoretical baseball discussions before, and I certainly get really opinionated when we get into discussions about, you know, the role of the manager and stuff like that. I certainly went into that part of my brain when all that Jim Riegelman craziness was going on. That really made me mad, but that's probably not something we should occupy time with about this podcast. I just thought that he was just completely mistreated by the media about his decision.
Yeah. Anyhow, last thought on the podcast. We're pushing an hour here on what was supposed to be another short one, because we say, let's make this a short one every time and then talk for a million
hours. Except we didn't say that this time, actually. I should clarify for everyone listening, our guest, we didn't know we had a guest until about 4 hours ago.
Oh, it's been a busy weekend, with the 4th and friends coming to town and stuff, and so we contacted the SB Nation Braves blog, Talking Chop, and I contacted one of their guys, and he said, oh, here's another, let me direct you to another guy, and then he finally got back to me this morning, and I was like, oh, crap, Greg's at work already, so I sent you a forbidden text message, because I know you don't do the text messagey thing, and it ended up being a great interview, but we didn't have a guest until we had a guest.
We also didn't know if we were even going to do this show because I had some internet issues over the weekend, and I didn't know if I was going to have internet at this point. And thankfully, yesterday it was able to be restored late in the evening.
Fantastic. Let's move to our last topic so we can let these All-Star people game. On with their days. All-Star game. So far, the only Rocky we have seen selected was Troy Tulowitzki in a bench role. And honest to God, if Bruce Bochy had not picked Tulowitzki. Oh, wait, I forgot. But the managers picked the pitchers and the players picked the reserves, right?
Actually, from the, I had the, TBS, All-Star Game announcement show on in the background as I was getting ready to go to work. And it seemed to me like the manager picked a couple reserves and a couple pitchers, while the players also picked a couple reserves and a couple pitchers.
Well, all I know for a fact is that Bochy picked Lincecum, Kane, and Vogelsong.
Yes,
and nice work there, Bochy.
Yes, and it's not. I'm not going to be too hard on Bochy for being crazy about it because
Clint Hurdle picked Aaron Cook, and. Granted, that turned out pretty well.
Yeah,
even though we lost the game, Aaron Cook was a freaking hero. Him and Christian Guzman making up for Dan Uggla and his 3 All-Star game errors, which make him a bad player automatically. The fact that he went with one of his own pitchers is nothing surprising at all. And Bochy, especially with the season Vogelsong's having, I don't like how good of a season Vogelsong's having. We all gripe about how this guy came out of freaking nowhere to suddenly become a passable major league pitcher again. Whatever. I would argue that those 3 are going to be good additions to the All-Star team because you know what? I want the National League to win the All-Star game. I don't care if it's Giants pitching out there because for one day of the year, nobody is, I mean, their teams, what team you play for doesn't matter except for the National League team.
Yes.
Or the American League team. And I don't care if you bring in every player that I hate from the National League as long as they're the best and they give us the best chance to win. And with Lincecum, Kane, and Vogelsong, I raise my eyebrow at Vogelsong. Lincecum and Kane are good additions in a general sense.
Yeah, and again, I'm just personally, I don't hold a manager too in a negative light here for picking some, you know, personal picks from your own team. I think that sort of happens all the time, and I only get really mad about it when there's a really clear case that that player doesn't deserve to be on the team. And that happens a lot less often on the original rosters than it does with the replacements they have to pick.
Oh, you mean like Omar Infante?
I can't really name any specific.
Last year he was picked because they for some reason, Bud Selig was like, put a utility man on the roster. And they're like, okay, how about Omar Infante? When they could have picked Carlos Gonzalez, so we had a couple, you know, another legitimate outfielder. Whatever, the National League won the game. Thank you, Marlon Byrd. And it turned out all right.
Right. And I guess that's basically what I'm saying, because the rosters go through a lot of different shifts. Not only do we add a couple more players after this second round of fan voting here for the last man, certain players are going to be hurt and others are going to not be eligible to pitch. As I recall, somebody was saying that, all the pitchers who are starting the day before the All-Star break are not eligible to play in the game. And I believe they're actually allowed to replace those players on the roster with more players. So it just starts to get really complicated, and you always get like these last three or four additions to each team to replace other players and so forth. And some of those guys end up being a little suspect.
Well, as far as Rockies fans are interested, Tulowitzki was picked as a reserve, and because Reyes is out, Reyes who won the All-Star voting, and I could rant again, it'd be the same rant as last year about why fan voting is stupid, or why the fact that it counts is stupid. Tulowitzki's gonna be starting the All-Star game, there's just no question about that, cause Reyes is, you know, dead, or injured, or one of those things.
Probably injured.
Yeah, I'm gonna guess injured, yeah. But no, good for Tulo. He deserves to be the National League All-Star starter. And ta-da. That's all I really got about that. I would like to see, I held this up for the, you know, last man on ballot, but there's just no way he's gonna win it because he plays for Colorado. And I hate to be, you know, all, woe is us, but it's kind of the fact of it. I mean, everyone, as far as everyone knows, Todd Helton's washed up. Even though he's having a good season and he's, you know, right middle of the pack, you know, upper third of National League first baseman. He's having a good season for himself. He's fielding like he always does. He's just being, you know, good old aging Todd Helton, and his back seems to be all right this year. But, you know, again, like I mentioned, or I'm going to mention in the Braves interview, so I won't go too much further into Helton here. If he doesn't make it, I'm not going to shed a tear. I would like to see him get the respect, but I would also like to see him get some rest and have a healthy back for the rest of July. That'd be swimmingly perfect.
Yeah, I would think that probably about the best Helton can hope for in terms of voting of those five players is about third. Even that might be pushing it a little bit. He'll probably beat, I can't remember who the five are. He'll probably beat the Nationals guy. Morse? I can't remember his first name.
Mike Morse?
Yeah, Mike, what's his name? Morse?
Isn't it Mike Morse?
It might be Mike Morse. Just doesn't sound
right. It's Rick Ross, Carl. That's exactly who it is. Okay, it's Michael Morse, yeah.
Okay.
The final five are Andre Ethier, he's not having the greatest season, having an okay season. Todd Helton. Ian Kennedy, who kind of needs to get in because of the whole hometown thing, but it's not going to happen. Michael Morse. And then the guy who's going to win it, Shane Victorino.
That was my thought. I was kind of thinking that Ethier and Victorino were probably going to get the first two slots, with Kennedy maybe as a dark horse over Helton being an even more significant dark horse. I think he's probably going to get fourth or last. But
all right, Helton's not going to get into this. There's no question about that. And I've said my piece on that. There's no sense in getting myself riled up because I just love Todd Helton. Yeah, that's all I have about the All-Star game. Let's just hope we win.
Yeah, since, I mean, not only for the getting some sort of, you know, you always kind of want to stand up for yourself a little bit in the face of some sort of grand assault on your credibility. And basically the past 9 years or so have been one giant assault by the American League on the National League's credibility. So in addition to that, obviously, in the off chance that we wind up in the World Series, we want the home field advantage there. So there you go.
Yeah, that's again, and I hope that more people can get behind this, that we can just say, you know what, for one game, I don't care who you play for except the National League. Let's go National League. I love the All-Star game because I love the National League, and I'm going to get all jingoist about it and stuff. And screw the American League.
All right, well, I guess that's everything we really have to say here. So I'm going to go ahead and move over to the interview that we did with Bennett Hipp, who is a writer, or I guess the editor of TalkingChop.com. We will see you after that. All right, everyone, we are on the line with Bennett Hipp, who is an editor over at TalkingChop.com, the SB Nation blog for the Atlanta Braves. Bennett, thanks for joining us today.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Now, Bennett, I couldn't help but notice that there's some connection with Ole Miss with you there. Did you realize that our own right fielder, Seth Smith, was one of them Ole Miss people?
Yeah, I'm a big Seth Smith fan, actually.
That's, everyone should be a big Seth Smith fan.
Oh, man. Absolutely. I'm a junior at Ole Miss right now, so and I write for the school paper covering the football team. So Seth Smith is a guy that, you know, I've heard for a couple of years and know about and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, one of the Rockies' big clients. Well, never mind, like, the fact that they're a professional baseball team and have good players and stuff. One of their other funny claims to fame is their affinity for drafting quarterbacks. Obviously, everyone knows Todd Helton, our first baseman, who was Peyton Manning's backup quarterback at Tennessee, and then they drafted Seth Smith, who was Eli Manning's backup at Ole Miss. I guess it's a good connection there.
Yeah,
that's what we heard, actually. Manning, Peyton, apparently, this may have been second hand, but someone claims that Peyton Manning was at the game and a couple days ago and decked out in Todd Helton gear. And that may or may not have been a rumor, but just I'm going to pretend that it was completely true. I don't know. I missed part of the broadcast, but I was able to keep up on the game itself. And well, you know how it goes. So I'm hoping it was true, just because that makes me feel like we're special. So, anyways, moving on to the actual topic at hand here. I'm sure we could talk about college football and how that relates to the Rockies all day long. But we brought you on to talk about the Atlanta Braves. So coming into the season, the Braves had relatively high expectations for them, given, you know, the wild card finish last year. And, well, it's a good team. The Braves are a very good team, and I have a lot of trouble disliking. I mean, there's a lot of good teams out there that sometimes you just hate. And this time, the Braves are a team that I really enjoy watching. It's a pretty solid bullpen, good pitching staff, and some exciting players in the starting lineup. So let me just jump right into, expectations for the rest of the season. Philadelphia obviously has taken a blow with Roy Oswalt going out for, you know, probably the season with his back injuries there. Do you think the Braves have a shot of taking advantage of a player going down, but obviously it's a weakness for the team ahead of you. Do you think there's a shot at them overtaking the division, or are you guys kind of playing for the wild card for the rest of the season?
I certainly think there's a chance that Atlanta could go ahead and make a run at the East. That's not out of the question at all. I mean, this team is, you know, 10, 11, 12 games over 500 with an offense that has underperformed all season long. You know, they've got one of the top pitching staffs in baseball, with the Phillies and the Giants, and, you know, they've ridden their pitching, you know, all season long, and here they are, four games ahead in the wild card, four games back in the East, and still waiting on everybody to get completely healthy. They're still waiting on Dan Uggla to start hitting, still waiting on Jason Hayward to start hitting. You know, Martin Prado comes back in a couple weeks, and then they can make a serious run at this thing and make the East a race to watch going down the stretch.
Yeah, you mentioned an interesting point there, waiting for Jason Hayward to start hitting. We see good peripherals there. The power's not quite where we'd like to see it so far, but a 174 ISO is absolutely nothing to sneeze at. But it looks like he's gotten robbed a bit on his ball and play average with a 269 BABIP. Is there something that we're missing beyond just, you know, statistical bad luck here? Or because his walk rates look good. I just mentioned his power rate is acceptable. A few more strikeouts than we're comfortable with at right about 24%. But he's an above average bat. Is there anything we're missing here with Hayward?
It's hard to tell. I mean, you look at the peripherals and you're just like, you see that he can be successful, and it's just not happening for him. You know, he went on the DL with a shoulder injury, and he said the shoulder had been hurting him since spring training. And so he struggled to start the year, and once the injury came about, you kind of figured, well, let him go on the DL, get the shoulder fixed, and then come back. He's come back, he's hit well, but the power's not there. There just looks to be something off mechanically in the swing, but, you know, he's so frustrating because you see the talent, and lately he's been driving the ball right into the ground. If he needs to get more loft on his balls and hit more line drives, once that starts to happen, I think you'll see him start to, his numbers look a little better. But right now, there's just something off in his game. It's really tough to tell.
To borrow the cliche, do you think he's just going through, you know, the sophomore slump that you see a lot of players going through?
I could
especially
definitely
after huge seasons as a rookie.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. You know, he changed up his stance a little bit in the offseason, and he's once he's at the plate, he's very far off the plate. And I think he tried to do that to adjust to what pitchers have been throwing to him, but he needs to still has some things in his swing he needs to figure out and make some adjustments because these pitchers have started to figure out the way to bust him inside, and he's having trouble handling those.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of trouble that with Ian Stewart, who is in AAA right now. He was supposedly going to start maybe not crowding the plate, but stepping in closer to the plate, because anything inside, he was just getting, or was it backing off the plate, Greg?
For Ian Stewart?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know specifically.
It was backing off.
He was just having all sorts of trouble.
Well, the inside pitch had always given Stewart trouble throughout his entire career there, leading to a lot of strikeouts on the inner half and stuff. So I have it mixed up, so sorry for those of you who are thinking, oh, this Andrew Greg doesn't know what he's talking about, because, you know, I don't know what I'm talking about. But, yeah, backing off the plate's a good step for him. An interesting rookie that I've been keeping an eye on since in every single sim league I've ever played in, Freddie Freeman's been a big target for me, and so far it hasn't been a bad rookie campaign at all. He's batting .267 with a .336 on base and a .425 slugging. The power's not quite there yet, but it's definitely an above-average bat, but questionable defense at first. Do you think these are all adjustments that Freeman is going to be able to make, or are we just kind of seeing, you know, what you get? After such domination in the minor leagues, I don't want to say I'm disappointed, but, you know, I think we're all a little spoiled by, you know, Jason Hayward and, like, for the Rockies, Troy Tulowitzki in his rookie year. What's the skinny on Freeman there?
I think you know, after Jason Hayward came up last year, you know, once the season ended, everybody was like, well, you know, Freddie Freeman's going to be the next guy. He's the next Jason Hayward. When he's truly not the next Jason Hayward, you know, there are very few Jason Haywards in Major League Baseball. So, you know, Freddie, every level he's been to in the minors and now in the majors, he started off very slowly, but then he gets the hang of the level, and then he hits. And, you know, it's come around this year. He started out slow, and then he started to hit. The main issue with him is he gets in these stretches where he completely loses his plate approach. He swings at balls all over the place, and he doesn't walk. Then back he gets back now to taking pitches, working the count, and that's when he's truly successful. He's really good at hitting the ball backside, which you don't see out of rookie players very often. But the key to him is plate approach and working the count. Defensively, he's very good on picking the ball at first, but at actually fielding the position, he's average at best. He's not very rangy. He looks awkward fielding the ball. So, you know, defensively, I think this is what we get. But the power is still to come. He's a big kid. He's still young. The power is going to come, and the key for him is plate approach.
So moving on to a different position here, as far as relatively new acquisitions go, Alex Gonzalez, 1 year later, well, I guess whenever the actual trade went down, we're looking at about a year-ish, right? Something like that. How are you feeling about the trade, you know, this far later in the, you know, this far after the actual event?
You know, Alex has been, he's been exactly what you would expect. The funny thing about Alex Gonzalez is he is consistently Alex Gonzalez. There's no worry about what he's going to do. His career average is, you know, .247. He's hitting .240 right now. You know, his career on base percentage is .293. He's hitting .273. So it's a little bit under, but he's consistently, you know, he's never going to surprise you. Atlanta sent Yunel Escobar to Toronto for Alex Gonzalez and Tim Collins. Atlanta turned Tim Collins into Rick Ankiel and Kyle Farnsworth last year at the deadline. They also got a shortstop named Tyler Pastrnicki back in that trade as well. Pastrnicki's at Double A, hitting right around .300. and looking to be the guy that steps in at shortstop in a year or two once Gonzalez leaves. For Gonzalez, the power was in Toronto. He's got a little pop, 8 to 10 homers, so far, but his glove is what we have him for. He's been fantastic defensively. For all the talk of Derek Jeter winning gold gloves and that kind of stuff, Alex Gonzalez truly deserves to win a gold glove this year. At the plate, he's very frustrating. He doesn't take walks. He swings at everything. But, you live with it because he's so great defensively and he's the anchor in the infield.
So last question about Escobar, Alex Gonzalez thing. We heard earlier this season, I believe it was Chipper saying that he really felt bad for Uni, that he wished it never went down. And then when the trade actually happened, we heard these stories about standing ovations for Alex Gonzalez. How much of this was overblown by a frustrated media? I mean, I'm sure we have conflicting reports everywhere, but maybe add one. Give me a little bit of insight on this before we move on from shortstops.
I truly think that there were people in Atlanta who just disliked, Escobar. He was a very flashy player. He made mental mistakes. He didn't really listen well to superiors and veterans. And, the reason they traded him is because they were just tired of putting up with his act. And I truly think that most of the players in Atlanta were happy to see him go. I mean, Chipper did not like him, He came out and last week when they played Toronto and said, there's no hard feelings. But there was, in the clubhouse, there was a very good feeling when, Escobar left and Alex Gonzalez came in. There were a lot of media accounts that Alex Gonzalez got a standing ovation in the clubhouse when he came in after being traded for Unel. Unel's a great player. And it's tough because he's so young and Alex is so old. But, and I would like to have back in a Braves uniform just because he's so talented. But at the same time, trading for Alex Gonzalez seemed to be the right move for Bobby Cox last year. And the front office, I think they were just tired of Escobar and his attitude.
That makes sense. The Rockies are also a team that prizes character above, a lot of other things. And, a lot of times that character ends up translating into better production than expected. So... character's a big deal. So, go ahead, finish your thought.
Atlanta's, they've always been very, very big on doing things the Atlanta Braves way. And, they've built a team full of character guys like Eric Kinski and David Ross and Brooks Conrad. Guys that aren't spectacular, but they're great clubhouse guys. Eric Kinski was a free agent in the offseason after playing with Atlanta last year. And he got a pretty good offer from Milwaukee to go back home and play for them. And Eric Kinski was a free agent priority for Atlanta. Yes, he's a very good bench bat, very good left-handed pinch hitter, can play some first base and left field. But the big reason that they re-signed him is because he is so good in the clubhouse. And, the Braves are a team that build their team that way with a bunch of good guys with no egos. So I think, just didn't quite fit in to what they were trying to build.
So let me ask a real random question here. How good do you feel about having a bat like David Ross backing up Brian McCann? Honestly, with a guy like that, I'm surprised that they haven't tried to trade him to some other team for, just for the sake of value. He's a backup catcher. David, obviously you don't want to just give up on someone who's been consistently an above-average bat, but, I just got to wonder with it. With a guy like Brian McCann there and Ross, not going to be playing more than, 60 games a year, tops. What's the deal there?
I mean, it's fantastic to know that, when the Braves are a team that their best hitter is their catcher right now. And when your best hitter is your catcher, you want to have a solid backup in case it goes down. It's like the Giants. They lost Posey, and they don't have a David Ross to kind of step in and fill that role, as well as they want to. I'm constantly amazed by David Ross. He hit the grand slam the other night, and those are the nights where you're just like, he is truly the greatest backup catcher in baseball. He's very good working with pitchers. He's great on pickoff throws. He's third on the team right now in and wins above replacement right now with 1.1 behind Martin Prado and Brian McCann. I was talking to a friend the other day, and they asked, you know, would you trade David Ross? And you would be stupid not to listen for offers, because David Ross could be starting for a good number of teams in baseball right now. But they truly value David Ross a whole lot because of how good McCann is with his bat. When you have, and Freddie likes to sit McCann at least once a week, maybe twice a week. And when you can sit McCann and have David Ross come in, the drop off is not that big at all. So he's a very key piece, and it's a joy to watch him play every fifth day.
I wanted to ask real quick about Jair Jurgens. I was looking at his FanGraphs page here, and obviously, I mean, we haven't seen you guys yet, but the word about how successful and how fantastic of a season he's had has certainly been getting around. And it's interesting to note that most of his pitching peripherals here, like walks per nine and so forth, have dropped off, but he's also striking out a batter less than he used to. Per nine, and I was just wondering what insight can you give on what has contributed to his turnaround? I don't want to say turnaround, but his giant step forward this season, and what you expect to get out of him over the next couple of years.
First off, he dropped his walk rate. You know, last year he walked about 3.25 batters per nine innings. Now he's down under two, and that truly has been the main reason for his success. You know, he's gotten lucky. His batting average on balls in play is 257. You know, his career average for that is 279. So there's a little wiggle room there. His strand rate's 84%. That's the highest it's ever been in his career. And, you know, the regression is coming, but the question is, how big is the regression going to be? You know, he's not a 2 ERA pitcher like he is right now with a 1.89 ERA. I think he's certainly, you know, a 3 ERA pitcher. You could even go lower than that. But he's using his control. He's pitching the contact. He's been fantastic so far in 2011. He's one of the two guys you look at to start the All-Star game with Roy Halladay. He's in contention for the Cy Young right now. And he's been great, but there's going to be a little bit of a drop-off, and that's already started. Last couple of starts, he's walked a few more than usual. But, you know, he's still been very, very good at the top of the Braves rotation so far this year.
So continue along the lines of pitching. Over here in the National League West, we're used to the San Diego Padres just suddenly coming out of nowhere, trading. They traded away a lot of their bullpen this year and then just brought up more guys who continue to be pretty decent. We've shared this frustration with Grant from McCovey Chronicles about, he described it as they were just forming relievers out of clay. I took the next step and, suggested that they were being built like the big troll ogre warriors from Lord of the Rings, you know, they're just mining relief pitchers out of nowhere. And the Braves this bullpen is disgusting. You got two pitchers with an ERA below 2, one of the more noteworthy ones being Erik O'Flaherty with a 1.16 ERA. And I'm looking through the regulars here, and out of guys with over 20 innings pitched, I mean, you've got, let's see, Linebrink, Christian Martinez, and Cody, is that Guerin?
Yeah, Corey Guerin.
Yeah, those guys have a 3.5, 3.6 ERA rate in there. Everyone else is in the 2s. And what's even almost more frustrating is, I mean, especially for, let's just say Dodgers fans, for example, as if they don't have enough frustrations to deal with, George Sherrill, 31 games, 20 innings pitch, and he's obviously being used as more of a lefty specialist, but yeah. She said 2.61 ERA and peripherals to match. I mean, this Braves bullpen is outstanding. It's untouchable. How critical? How did you do it? That's what I got to know. How did you guys? How much of this was farm? How much was trade? How much was luck? How much of this was channeling Leo Mazzoni into the current pitching coach?
You know, going down the list, Craig Kimbrell was a draft. Johnny Venters used to be a starter in the minors. He was very average. He wasn't special. He had Tommy John, came back, and moved to a reliever. Erik O'Flaherty was put on waivers by the Seattle Mariners, picked up by the Braves, and He's been a great left-handed reliever for 2 years now. George Sherrill is a free agent signing. He's being used correctly as a left-handed only guy. You know, Corey Guerin is another draft guy. Peter Moylan, same there. Scott Proctor was a free agent signee, and he's been the worst reliever so far. Linebrink was acquired in a trade with the White Sox in the offseason. They've done very well piecing together this bullpen. There were a lot of questions last year when Billy Wagner retired, if Kimbrel was ready, if Johnny Venters was ready. And, you know, so far they've both shown to be fantastic. And with Eric O'Flaherty, they've got probably the best three pitchers, you know, in a single bullpen, you know, in baseball. It's impressive.
Yeah, it's been, I'm not looking forward to, playing you guys here this, this upcoming series, because I just know the trouble the Rockies have with bullpens, and oh boy, here we go. It's gonna be a blast, isn't it? Although knowing this team though, they're gonna somehow, like, they're either gonna get, like, perfectoed, or they're going to shell everyone for, like, 8 runs a game. There's, like, no in between with this team. And I just don't understand it. So, let's see. Go ahead.
You can, there's always hope, you know, Freddy Gonzalez insists on A, keeping Scott Proctor on the roster, and B, using him in key situations. And it boggles my mind as to why he is on a major league roster. He throws hard, throws 95 miles an hour, but I think he's got pictures of Freddy Gonzalez selling drugs or doing something, because there's no reason for him to be on the team. And they used him today. Up 4-3 in the seventh, he gave up a 2-run home run to Mark Reynolds, to make it 5-4 Baltimore. And if that wasn't enough, Freddie kept him in for the eighth, where he walked a guy and hit a guy before they finally pulled him. But he's been the weak link in the bullpen. So if you see Scott Proctor coming in, you know, breathe a sigh of relief, you know, grab some popcorn. It's going to be fun to watch for y'all. But everybody else has been rock solid. It's been a great, great bullpen so far.
All right, Greg, write that down. Scott Proctor equals good for us.
Although knowing the Rockies, they're going to do the exact opposite and make Proctor look brilliant, and then strike against somebody else.
Yeah, Scott Proctor's going to somehow strike out. Like, it's going to end up just, you know, the fate's all falling against him. He's going to strike out 6 batters in the inning. Meaning, you know, there's going to be all that many drop third strikes somehow by McCann, yeah. And the bases are going to be jacked, even though Scott Proctor struck anyone out, and no one will take a walk on him. And all of a sudden, he'll induce that last strikeout against someone we need to not strike. It'll be like Wigginton or something like that. Although Wigginton will have probably homered earlier in the game, which just basically means the Rockies are going to lose.
It's so strange, you know, they see Scott Proctor come in, and I've never seen Braves fans root against someone so bad, because they just want him off the team. You know, they see Scott Proctor warming up, and they're just like, really, this guy again? And then they see him, you know, blow a lead or give up 2 hits or walk 2 guys, and then he leaves. And yet he's still there. And so it's gotten to the point where I'm not sure if Braves fans want Scott Proctor to do well anymore. I think they just want him gone. It's strange.
Yeah, I'm pulling up the numbers right here just, cause we're looking, I have Fangraphs up, and that's obviously not up to date for Sunday. But before Sunday's game, he had a 3.14 ERA, and after today's game, he's sitting on a, you know, 4.02, which is obviously, you know, not good, especially with a small inning load. But still, I mean, when your weakest link in your bullpen has a 3.14 ERA, even if peripherals don't back him up, I mean, holy smokes. There's, most teams in the majors would kill for that kind of a problem.
Oh yeah, it's, you know, it's nice to be able to say that you've got 6 guys in the bullpen you feel really confident about. And Proctor is just, you know, the peripherals aren't there. He's striking out less than 6 guys per 9 innings. He's walking more than 4. You know, he gives up the home run. His batting average on balls in play is an ungodly low 209. You know, and that's not going to stay the same. He's been getting hit hard, but like you said, it's a nice problem to have when that's your worst reliever in the pen.
all right, well, let's move on from Scott Proctor. As much as we'll talk about Proctor and then make Joe Torre jokes, because it's impossible not to. How about the All-Star game? The Braves are looking at quite the load of representatives. You got Brian McCann, the catcher. You got Jared Jurgens in the pitching staff, along with Johnny Venters. And we're also looking at Chipper Jones as one of the bench players. We'll touch Jones last, because I figure that's a good take us out question. But
yeah.
I don't know, how you feeling about your All-Star selections? We were mentioning before the podcast that it's everyone, basically All-Star selection comes out and 95% of baseball fans complain, and I'm just picturing Braves fans sitting quietly being like, all right, that's four guys, that's pretty good.
90% of those 95% of people complaining were Yankees fans complaining about Sabathia, I'm sure.
Well, as well they should, but...
Yeah, you know, they came out, and I'm finally glad to see Brian McCann getting the start. He deserved that for a couple years, and he finally got ahead of Molina this year to start, and... That's where I'm truly, you know, happy for a guy that's worked so hard, and been one of the best catchers in baseball, and for him finally to get the starting nod is nice to see. But overall, I'm pretty happy for All-Stars, and I would have liked to seen Craig Kimbrel get in as well as Tommy Hansen, but, especially for a guy like Kimbrel, you know, missing the game isn't the worst thing in the world. He's been used a lot, and a couple of days of rest during the All-Star break can't hurt. But overall, you have to be pretty happy with four selections.
Greg, did you have anything else to throw in there before you move on to Chipper?
Not about the All-Star game.
Well, go ahead and ask anything else you got.
Well, the only other thing that I think might be curious to some of us Rockies fans out there about the Braves is, you know, obviously from the outsider's perspective, the presence of Bobby Cox on your team has always been sort of part of the perceived identity of the Atlanta Braves. And, you know, I obviously can't speak to how it has changed or affected, or perhaps not changed or affected, the mindset or the perspective of yourself or your fan base. And so I was wondering if you could enlighten how Freddie Gonzalez may be a little different for the way the Braves are perceived, or how you perceive them, or if you haven't really noticed the difference at all.
Yeah, you know, it's you know, Bobby Cox was the only. I'm 20 years old. I'll turn 21 next month. Bobby Cox is the only Braves manager I've known since I was, you know, old enough to remember players' names and start pulling for the Braves. And, you know, last year it was tough to see him go. I watched the press conference after the San Francisco Giants loss, and I was just, I didn't want to believe it that he was gone. You know, that's all you know. But, you know, they moved very quickly on Freddie. Once Freddie got fired from the Marlins last year during the season, it was pretty much a foregone conclusion. You know, he was coming back to Atlanta. They moved very quickly on him and signed him. And he's been so-so. He hasn't been great. He hasn't been, no, it's really tough to replace someone like Bobby Cox. And, I think one of the things that we all miss the most is Bobby Cox was very vocal about standing up for his players. And, you know, we all know his penchant for arguing with umpires and getting thrown out of games and all that kind of stuff. And you just don't see that kind of fire from Freddie sometimes. And it's tough because you expect your manager as a Braves fan to be out there arguing calls, arguing balls and strikes. And Freddie doesn't do that a whole lot. He likes to hit and run a lot. He likes to steal bases. The Braves aren't very good at stealing bases. Yet he likes to hit and run with guys like Dan Uggla and Freddie Freeman. It doesn't work out very well. And, you know, I mentioned Scott Proctor in the bullpen. He's not the best at picking his spots for relievers, but at the same time, he's done a very, very good job, making sure guys like Brian McCann and the fragile Chipper Jones guest. He's had his ups and his downs. He hasn't been great, but I mean, he hasn't been absolutely terrible. But you know, there's certainly room for improvement for Freddie going forward.
So, final question for me, unless you had anything else, Greg.
Not that I can think of.
All right. Well, so Chipper Jones got the last selection for the Braves as a, well, assume, you know, last, you know, currently announced suggestion as to that last last man in vote thing, but Chipper is a very questionable addition to me, and I'm kind of wondering why he would get picked. Being in the twilight of his career, do you think this is just a respect vote, or, you know, what am I missing here? Because he's looking very, well, like I said, end of his career.
Yeah, I was watching the show today, and I heard his name pop up, and I looked up and was completely surprised. Polanco, I think, is a starter at third, and I don't really agree with that either. Chase Headley has been the best third baseman in the National League in my book so far, going by statistics, and he's not on there. But it's purely a legacy vote for Chipper this year. I'm the biggest Chipper Jones fan there is, and you can't put it any other way. His numbers don't really back it up, but the players voted for him, I think, and he's the guy that got in on a legacy vote this year. But I really do think Chase Headley deserves to be on the team. He's been fantastic for San Diego so far.
Yeah, we've had some discussion about that at Purple Row with Wigginton being the surprising leader in home runs in the National League, unless I'm missing someone there. Whatever, Wigginton's doing really good at third base, and he wasn't expected to really be a third baseman, more of a backup third baseman, backup first baseman, play some corner outfield, stuff like that. And then, you know, God forbid, 14th inning, double switch has already happened. He has to play second base. I guess I just got to wonder, Chipper's had a phenomenal career, and I don't mean to take anything away from the man, but
yeah.
Helton's kind of sort of having a better one, and where's the respect there? Come on, Bruce Bochy, where are you? I'm being a complete homer about it, but come on, it's Todd Helton. The guy has never gotten the love he deserves ever.
Absolutely. I think part of Chipper getting on this year is just the relatively weak crop of third basemen in the National League. With David Wright being hurt, Ryan Zimmerman being hurt, and nobody really knowing outside of the people who follow baseball closely who Chase Headley is, you know, you've got the Philly fans, you know, blindly voting for Placido Polanco. But it's just a weak crop of third basemen, and Chipper just seemed to luck out and get the legacy vote in a weak class.
I guess it stands to reason there with, you know, Prince, Votto, I guess I was about to say Adrian Gonzalez, but...
Not anymore.
Nope, playing for Boston. But, yeah, it makes more sense in that regard. And
yeah.
I just like to see that you're... He's one of, I think, four players in the majors to have as much tenure with a team as he does, and the other three being Ichiro, Jeter, and Chipper. So, I don't know,
yeah.
Obviously, once again, we're homers. Welcome to the Colorado Rockies Purple Row podcast here. I mean, we want to see Helton get more love because, you know, his career, putting up numbers that I wouldn't say rivaled Barry Bonds's, but we're clear second best in the National League, even if you take, you know, adjustment numbers up. Nope, finishing fifth in the MVP voting. Nope, can't give it to Todd Helton because he's Todd Helton, plays with the Rockies, blah, 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 blah. And this is where I get bitter and stomp around my room for a little while and then realize that I'd almost rather have Helton not playing and just resting so he has a nice strong
yeah.
back going into the rest of July. But still, respect our players.
Yeah, that's the tough thing about Helton. He's played really well, and I looked it up the other day just – you know, out of curiosity, he's been playing well. He just has the bad luck of being around, you know, when Ryan Howard and Gabby Sanchez and all those guys, there's a good crop of young first basemen, you know, Joey Votto, Ike Davis when he's healthy. And you just kind of forget about Todd Helton in the Colorado Rockies. You know, he's been doing it for so long that you kind of take it for granted. And then you look at it and you're like, wow, he's been hitting really well. And you just forget about him, and it's a shame.
Well, I think that's about all I got at the moment here, unless you had anything else you want to throw in, Greg.
Well, I think I should just mention that, of course, remind everybody that the last time Ubaldo Jimenez pitched in Turner Field, we got the first no-hitter in Colorado Rockies history, and he'll be facing, I believe it's Tommy Hansen tomorrow, yeah?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Yeah, let's totally count on that. That's yeah.
Probably not going to happen again, but just something to think about.
Well, we've talked a lot here, Bennett. Do you have any last thoughts that you want the Colorado Rockies listeners to hear about, or think we're done here?
Not really. I'm looking forward to the series. There's a couple of looking at the pitching matchups right now. I haven't been able to see Shaheen, or I'm not sure how you say it, but I haven't been able to see him pitch this year, but his numbers have been fantastic, so I'm looking forward to that on Tuesday.
Hopefully his arm is okay. He was pushed back a couple of starts earlier in the week, but I think I haven't heard anything about him being set any longer, so I think it'll probably be good to go.
Good stuff. Well, I'm looking forward to the series. It should be a good one. The Braves play pretty well at home, but, you know, they've been winning very ugly lately, and they haven't been blowing people out, so it should be four pretty competitive games, so I'm looking forward to it.
All right, well, Ben, thanks very much for being on the show with us, and we will, you know, good luck this series. We hope we sweep you, and good
right
things like that.
Thanks for having me, guys.
All right, everybody. We will be back within 2 weeks this time. We're not going to have an episode on July 11th. That is, I just got to say, I'm a little tired of doing a podcast every week. So
we hope you all love it and appreciate it.
Just a mid-season rest period, and I mean, unless some really crazy breaking news happens over the next week with the Braves and the Nationals, there's not a lot to talk about the All-Star break. I mean, we just summarized all the thoughts we had about the upcoming All-Star game, which is still over a week away, in about 10 minutes. And we don't really need to stretch a whole podcast into that. So it's kind of the opportune time to rest a little bit, and then we should be back, barring any unforeseen complications, on the 18th of July. So, yeah, unless you've got anything else that you want to share here, Andrew?
Let me think. No. Okay. Not a thing I want to share. I'm, not terrible. As you heard in the end of the interview there, I'm not looking forward to the series. I hope we sweep them, but I'm, kind of terrified of that bullpen. I'm not going to lie to you.
Yeah, it's going to be, I know you said in the interview that you don't have anything really against the Braves. I think, the Braves were kind of the first, real nemesis for the Rockies in those early years. And as a result, there's kind of this anti-Atlanta, even if it's not really taken that seriously anymore, there's just kind of an anti-Brave kind of feeling around Rockies fandom. And that's never really been present for me. And of course it's the same with the Dodgers for me. The Braves and Dodgers are my second and third favorite NL teams. So
yeah, you're weird like that.
Yes, it's true. We'll be back in 2 weeks. And until then, hopefully you'll survive without us. And as always, take care.